Hello, this is For Art's Sake, a podcast that gives voice to museum people. Here we pull the curtain to hear the untold stories, for art's sake and for your sake.
Our guest this week is a true pioneer in her field. So Claire Madge is a central figure in the promotion of accessible museums across the UK. She's the founder of Autism in Museums, an initiative working to create autism-friendly change across the cultural sector. She's a tireless volunteer. Her work stems from her personal connections to autism, and for her efforts, Claire has earned the Museum and Heritage Volunteer of the Year Award. This reflects her work with some really big museums, places like the V&A and the British Museum, as well as smaller institutions like the Jewish Museum. As part of her work with Autism and Museums, Claire has travelled the length and breadth of the country, sharing best practice at events and conferences. It's always really inspiring to hear Claire speak, and today she's going to share her personal and professional stories with us.
Welcome, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It's lovely to be here.
We'd love to start with some questions about autism in museums. And your work mostly revolves around access and inclusion for people who have an autistic spectrum diagnosis. For anyone unfamiliar with autism, could you please elaborate what autism is and perhaps just as importantly, what it isn't?
Yeah. So autism spectrum condition is a, as it says in the diagnosis, is a spectrum. So it affects people very, very differently. So you can have someone with autism who is nonverbal, who may have learning difficulties, who'll need support for their whole life. But equally, you can have someone who is autistic who has something called Asperger's, where they don't have any learning difficulties, but they might have problems with social communication and social interaction. So it doesn't lessen the difficulties that they face. There's certainly a lot more awareness around autism in the media now, and you'll see it portrayed on television. I think there's even a storyline running in EastEnders at the moment about their autistic son. But I think some of the challenges with autism is that it's such a wide spectrum and every autistic person is different. So how you support that in a museum context can be seen to be quite challenging when in fact there's some, you know, simple things to make a difference. What autism isn't, it isn't a disease. It isn't something you catch. It isn't something you grow out of. And it isn't a mental health condition. Quite often, if you are autistic, you might have co-occurring conditions. So you might have ADHD, you might suffer with depression, but that just because you are autistic doesn't mean to say that you're going to have those conditions come through in your life. Mm. But yeah, so that's, sorry, not the best description, but a quick description.
Roughly how many people have an autism spectrum diagnosis in terms of percentage of the population?
The National Autistic Society, I think, put it in 1 in 100.
Okay.
But I would say that's probably conservative. I think there's a lot of adults who don't have a diagnosis. And I think the way it impacts families as well, it's not just the individual, it's everyone involved that it impacts. So I think they put it, if you include families, they put it at 2.8 million. But I would say that's fairly conservative. But a lot of people say, I'm a little bit autistic, you know, because they like things a certain way or they struggle with noise or interacting in large groups. But I think the difference is when it really impacts on your day-to-day life and that you're really struggling to form social bonds, to find work, to live a happy and fulfilled life. And I think that's the difference, really.
And why did you choose museums as a place to raise awareness about this condition?
So it was about 7 years ago, I was working and my children, I've got three children and two are on the autism spectrum. At that point, they hadn't been diagnosed. And I was working, I've always loved history. I've got a degree in history. And I saw that the charity Kids in Museums were doing the Family Friendly Museum Award. And as part of that award, when they had the shortlist, you would go as a family and be family judges. And it was walking around a museum, it was the Museum of London actually, really watching my family and seeing how they reacted, that I'd never really considered how the environment might impact on their visit and why it might be difficult or how inspired they might be. And it made me really analyse it in a way I'd not really done before. And then a little while later, we had a bad experience at Museum of London where my daughter had a sensory reaction to a Tweeting Bird song soundtrack. And it was just such a stressful situation. And I just thought, I'm sure there was things that the museum could do to support us on our visit. And that really made a big difference. But 7 years ago, when my daughter was finally diagnosed, I decided to quit my job because I was just struggling. She didn't want to go to school. So to get her to go to school and manage all three kids and try and work, it was just all getting too much for me. And I thought originally museums were going to be something just for me. I thought I'd go and volunteer one day a week in my local museum. And that would just keep me sane, give me something to do while the kids were at school, keep my work skills up, keep going out and communicating and doing things like that. And so originally that one day a week was supposed to actually just be for me, really, because I love museums and I love history. And then it just developed. I thought I would write a blog about volunteering. I thought maybe I'll go to some exhibitions and write about that. And I wrote a couple of blogs and I had, you know, about 10 views on them or something. And then we went to the Science Museum and they run autism early opening called Early Birds, where they open up, I think it's at 8 o'clock in the morning before the crowds. And it's lovely and quiet. And I wrote a blog about that and it had 1,000 views in a day. And it's been read about, I think, 8,000 times. And it just really made me aware how many families need that experience, how many families feel isolated. And museums got in contact asking, like, you know, we've read your blog. How can we do something like this? How can we reach these families? And I think it's really from there that everything started to grow and develop, because I realised the power of writing those kinds of stories, connecting to museums and to families, and that was something that just grew and grew.
What are some of the things that museums can do to be more welcoming places for people with autism?
There's huge amounts that museums can do, and it varies depending on whether they're large or small museums as well. Not every museum needs to open up early. Big museums like the Natural History Museum and the Science Museum, they're obviously so busy all the time and it really works for them to open up early. But obviously there is a financial implication to that, having staff in early. So quite often they need funding to be able to run those initiatives. But for smaller museums, there's lots you can do. Training and awareness for staff and volunteers. And that extends to security, front of house, people in the cafe. Because quite often you find learning staff are really well trained. But if you leave the activity that you're doing with the learning staff and then leave via the front and you have a security guard that you might have a negative reaction with, that spoils the whole visit. So learning and awareness is really, really important. And it also empowers staff to feel that they know more. They're not going to say the wrong thing. I think people worry that they're going to do the wrong thing and say the wrong thing. And it helps staff in, that training helps staff in their day-to-day life, because quite often you speak to people and they have autistic grandchildren, they might have an autistic brother or sister. So there's quite a lot of awareness out there. But there are also misconceptions that children may be having a meltdown, so maybe crying or trying to run away or wanting to touch things, that's bad behaviour. And quite often it's a reaction to the environment. So that training is key. And there, for a lot of autistic people, knowing what's going to happen when you come to the museum is can cause a lot of anxiety, because they can't really predict what's going to happen. What are the spaces going to be like? Are they going to be dark? Are they going to be light? Is there going to be loud noises? They might not like mannequins. So museums can do a huge amount by putting pre-visit information on their website so that visitors can prepare before they come. So they can have a look and see what's going to happen on the day. How do they get to the museum? This pre-visit information needs to extend past the front door. So what's the journey to the museum? That's really important as well.
As you said, it's very important that the staff in museums, that they know what to do in these situations. Maybe there are some quiet spaces. Speaking of quiet places, you have already mentioned early openings in museums a few times. Can you please tell us more about these early openings? How does it work in practice?
Yeah, sure. So I've just actually been working with the British Museum on their first early opening. So again, that is another museum that is very, very busy, long queues to get in, very difficult environment to be in with the crowds. So their early opening was about restricting the open space to a number of galleries based around Greece and Greek myth, but they also kept the Great Court open so families could come and experience that without loads of other people. So they open up early in the morning. They train all the staff who are going to be on that day. So they're aware of some of the behaviours they might see. For example, some autistic children will flap or stim, where they might spin around, and that's okay. And they talked about relaxing some of their rules that they might have. So around touching. I thought it was really interesting. We were in one room and there was a storytelling going on and a girl was throwing her soft teddy around, you know, and it bounced off this sort of ancient Greek statue. And I was really surprised, like the security guard was like, no, it's fine. You know, it's not doing any damage. On a normal regular visit, that might not be acceptable, but we're going to just relax the rules a little bit here, which is really important. So for that event, a visual story was sent out beforehand via email. A visual story explains exactly what's going to happen, where the toilets are, where every activity is, what you can do on the day, how to get to the museum. And there was also a sensory map, which explains which areas of the museum are very dark or light, or where you might hear noise. And then we had a number of activities on the day. And these are just like any activities that you'd have on an event. There's just an awareness around the fact that some children might, for example, not want to get their hands dirty. Some children are very sensitive to touch. And so an activity where you might make something out of clay would be quite problematic if you can't clean your hands straight away. My children are like that. They're like, yeah, that was great for 10 seconds. I need to wash my hands now. We had that going on. We had a sensory storytelling where children could take part. So all this happened early. They restricted the numbers, so there weren't loads and loads of families there. And it was a fantastic event. My family came as well. And I think half of the families that came on that day, it was their very first visit, which just shows you how important these things are.
So through your work with autism museums, you promote events like these early bird mornings. Are there any that are coming up that you're particularly excited about that you think are going to be really special?
There's so many now. I'm so thrilled that there's so many. When I founded Autism in Museums, I eventually put all the information about it on my website and I put a calendar of events. And originally there was only one or two, and now there are so many events, and that is fantastic. But some of the really good ones, I think definitely for the big museums, the Science Museum are running their first event for families after hours, which is really important because a lot of events are early in the morning, which suit a lot of families. My family are up very early. Travelling into London is quiet at that time. But for many families, sleep is a real issue. So travelling into London really early in the morning is just never going to happen. So having choice, like everyone else has, choice to visit when you want is really important. So the Science Museum are going to be running their first for families after hours, which is brilliant. And now I'm seeing it coming into, because you get autistic adults, not just children. It doesn't disappear when you leave school. And I'm seeing more venues thinking about their offer to adults as well. So the V&A have run a quiet opening for Dior. And just this week on Monday, I was at the Royal Academy for their very first relaxed opening for Anthony Gormley. And again, that was such an amazing experience. And I don't know if anyone has been to that exhibition. It's quite challenging to be in some of those spaces with some of the objects. So to have a bit more time and space and not be full of crowds. And that was just an hour. That was 9 till 10, just that bit earlier, you know, and that was just an amazing experience. And they're looking to do that again for Picasso in March, I believe. So there's so much coming on for different ages, all types of museums, galleries. But if you look on the calendar on the Autism in Museums website, you'll see lots of different events all around the country as well, not just in London.
You have so many roles across the sector, and you worked and volunteered at some of the largest cultural places in the UK, and you head the initiative that is called Autism in Museums. And you also run one of the most popular social media accounts out there. So, but could you please describe to our listeners and to us what is it that you do in a bit more detail?
It's really, there's so many things. There's too many things, I think, I'm finding at the moment. So I began mainly volunteering, and I volunteered in my local museum, which sadly the local authority closed. So that was very difficult, but I wrote about that on my blog. But at the moment, I volunteer at Museum of London. I'm a collection care volunteer. I've only managed, I think, one day this year, which is really, really bad, but they're brilliant. But going behind the scenes is really important, and getting hands-on with objects, because you remember why museums are there and how much work goes into conserving and looking after. And that's really important to me when I go to an exhibition. So I volunteer. Also at the Globe Theatre, I'm on their access panel. We haven't done a huge amount again this year, but it's really important for me to stay in touch with different cultural venues, not just museums, but theatres as well. So I write Tincture of Museum blog, write about volunteering and exhibitions, and that keeps me really, really busy. I go to press views and get to lots of different venues. Obviously, Autism in Museums, this was more, it began more as just me, my passion. It wasn't about earning money or anything. But I just got so busy and so many people were asking me that that has now developed into a consultancy. So I actually earn money after like, you know, six and a half, seven years.
Yes.
Yeah, that's been amazing. That is growing. I do training and work with different venues. It's just been fantastic. So I'm also on the National Lottery Heritage Fund Committee for London and the South. So they're a funding body that decide where lottery funding goes for good causes. I've been doing it nearly 2 years. That's a really challenging role because funding is obviously on the decrease. Lots of projects come to us for funding and they're all worthy projects. As a committee, we come from different areas of our region, so down to Cornwall and down the south coast, as well as London. And we come together to make decisions on which projects should get funding. And we really look at not just here's some money for you to go and build a new exhibition or a new museum, but how are you going to work with volunteers? How are you going to support them and train them for the future? How are you going to be accessible? How are you going to take this money but really make it a work for everyone? And it's really challenging, but I love it because again you get to see things that are happening across the whole country, which is fantastic.
So prior to your work with museums, you worked as a researcher, and that was for the Financial Times, I believe, as well as London School of Economics. And then some changes in your personal life led to some changes in your professional life. Can you go into that story in a little bit more detail?
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, pretty conventional route. Did a degree in history because I just love history, love doing research. I realised really I'm just doing research even now for the blog. So I've basically just carried that on the whole time. But I did a degree in history. I really didn't know what I wanted to go and do, which lots of people don't know and still don't know. It's not like it magically becomes clear as you get older. I did a graduate trainee year at the Financial Times, and then I did a master's in library and information studies. Worked in a law firm for a while. Then a researcher role came up at the FT and they said, would you come back? And it was fantastic because every day was different and you never knew what research you were going to do. So that was really good. And then in my last role before I quit, I was at the London School of Economics. And it was great because it was when you have kids, you know, you can work full time, but it's difficult. And financially, sometimes you have to. But I actually went on a 1 year contract there because I'd had my eldest daughter. And I was worried that if I stayed in one role and then maybe had a break, it's really hard to then get another role. And I saw this job come up, which is a 1 year contract. And I thought, oh, I can't hurt to just go and do that. And I think it was 2 or 3 days a week. And they ended up extending it basically, which was fantastic. And I've been doing that for nearly seven years. And then all the stress at home, 3 young kids, and lots of things happened, you know, just, I got a new boss. He was younger than me. It's always one of these signs you go, okay, I'm not going anywhere, but I'm not working full time. And it's, you can't always run a department if you're just there like 1.5 days a week. Things happened in my personal life. And I think I was at breaking point, I think, to be honest. And it was a very hard decision to quit my job. Financially, we were kind of lucky and unlucky. My father-in-law died. He left us a little bit of money. And me working wasn't the most important thing. But it was really scary to have always worked and then to have to step away from that and a degree and a master's and feel like you're throwing it all all away. That was really hard. And volunteering was supposed to just be something to keep my hand in, but it has been life-changing, definitely, 100%, and the best thing I ever did. And I do completely different stuff now. And if you told me when I quit my job that in 7 years I'd be doing all this, I would not have believed it at all. I think you don't have one career anymore. You don't have one thing that you start and finish with. And there will be times when you want to change. And that is really hard. I think coming into museums is really hard. The pay is terrible, absolutely terrible. Coming from a different field, for me to earn what I earned before, it's just not going to happen. But I think it's how you approach it, and if you're committed and passionate, that will take you a long, long way, definitely.
Since you launched Autism in Museums, you worked with some, or most of the largest cultural institutions in the UK, the British Museum, Museum of London, to name but a few. Let's discuss a few particular examples associated with this museum's particular projects.
Should we start with the British Museum, possibly? Yeah, if we can start with the British Museum, can you describe what you did with them?
That's been the biggest piece of work I've done today, and that has been a paid piece of work I'm still doing. And so it's been a bigger piece of work because it's not only going walking around the museum and having a look at where they're going to have their morning event and giving them advice, but looking over their printed material. We are evaluating the event, so we've been interviewing families, and we're going to do some visitor mapping, looking at the journey of the visitors to that event before they've got to the museum. So looking at how that all worked and if there is some learning that we can take from that. That was, you know, a paid piece of work, but I think one of my favourite pieces of, I call it work, but this was volunteering, was at the Museum of London. Because I went to the Museum of London on something called a volunteer inclusion project, and that really kicked off my blog. It was a fantastic project which took people from all different walks of life, not just people who want to work in museums or have degrees. And we worked on archaeology, repacking archaeology, public engagement, and it was just amazing to be able to touch Roman objects. And I love that project, but I think our one was a 10-week project and it comes to an end. And I know my volunteer manager there, Adam Corsini, is just fantastic. And I knew he was looking to do that project again. And I suggested working with an autism group who are near me called Casper. And they support young, old, teenage autistic people. And they were really struggling. I'd sent them a list of my family events and they said, that's fantastic for young people, but we have a lot of young adults who aren't in work and not in education, and they could really do with some support and some experience. I went to Adam and said, would he work with them? And he was like, yep, let's do this. And we ran this project for these young adults, and it was very challenging for them. The communicating, being there every day, working, they did documentation, they took photographs of the archaeology, and the final day they had to do public engagement, which a lot of them were really, really worried about. But they managed it and they were amazing. And there were lots of things that came out of that project. Some of it was even just about independent travel into London, getting some confidence, realizing what else is out there. It's definitely a highlight, I think, of everything that I've done. And it went on to win a London Volunteering in Museums Award for Best Team. And one of the young volunteers went on to win Volunteer of the Year at the Museum of London as well. So I really hope it kickstarted a few careers as well.
And we understand that you work with the Museum of London on a regular basis. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I volunteer with them. It's getting harder and harder to find the time to do that. But I like the flexibility that they offer with their volunteering. And because it's behind the scenes, I don't have to be there every week. But the staff are really, really supportive and always happy to share their knowledge and experience. And that's why I'm still there all these years later.
And could you tell us what changed during the time you worked there?
At the Museum of London?
Yes, yeah.
What changed in what respect?
With regard to provision for autistic people.
Okay, yeah. They also run early bird events now as well. They have two sites, Museum of London Docklands and the main Museum of London site. But it's a really interesting time for the museum because they are planning a brand new museum at Smithfield. So they're thinking about what a museum is and what a museum should be is really interesting at the moment. And it's a really interesting place to be to hear those conversations about access and how we open up collections to everyone.
Are there any other museums that you work with on a regular or semi-regular basis through either Autism in Museums or the National Literary Heritage Fund?
It's hard to get it out.
Yes, I know.
I work with so many. It's fantastic. I have to give a huge thank you to the Jewish Museum in London. They're a lovely museum who gave me one of the very first museums to actually pay me, which was brilliant.
That's always nice.
I think it's always been really hard because I'm tossing up, like, I want to do good and I want museums to change, and you just want to offer that for free. But when it comes at the expense of your life and time and everything, there has to be a change. But another organisation that I work with a lot is Kids in Museums, the charity. So I helped do the first round judging for the Family Friendly Museum Award this year. And that's brilliant because you do get a snapshot across the whole country, including Scotland and Wales, about what's going on in museums, from small volunteer-run museums to the really big museums. And what was lovely is that so many that came through, it's finally judged by families, but so many who won their categories, I've worked with or have knowledge of, and I know that they're doing fantastic stuff. So, for example, Museum of Liverpool, they won the large category. And I did some fundraising for Autism in Museums, and they offered me a room to give training for free. So they were fantastic.
So obviously there's a lot of focus on young people when we talk about autism. Who tends to be the main audience for your work with Autism in Museums?
I think mainly it is families and children. That is where a lot of museums' focus and funding goes. Teenage market is really difficult for museums, regardless of whether you have any additional needs. But I think museums can do so much for that age range, definitely. But I'm continually getting people saying, well, that's great, but that's for kids and I can't come to that. Mm. So museums are looking at, some will offer just a sensory afternoon. So some heritage venues like castles will offer just a sensory afternoon, open to everyone, not restricted to children, where they look at their environment and offer visual stories and support information. And I think there is becoming more of awareness that adults would benefit. So I'm definitely seeing that starting to come through. I mean, like Royal Academy, I mean, obviously that was open to families, but it's an opportunity for adults as well. And you are seeing that starting to come through, which is fantastic.
So you work inside and outside different cultural institutions. But in your opinion, what is your great achievement there to date?
To date,
yes.
Yeah. Oh, that's really difficult. I'm hugely proud of Autism in Museums because it has been challenging to keep taking it to the next level, and it's needed a huge amount of work, and I do feel it's really making an impact. And that's really important to me because I can see the impact it's made on my family with my daughter and the confidence that she's got from travelling into London and visiting museums and being inspired by theatre, because we went to the Globe to a relaxed performance, and that's led on to her doing drama at GCSE. And she has an amazing singing voice and she's learning to perform. And she was in, you know, she went and saw Bob Dylan, Girl from the North Country, at the Old Vic. And I never thought she would get in there. You know, she'd never been in a theatre. And they were brilliant. They did visual stories for her. We went up the day before to have a look at the theatre. The fact that we go up to London regularly meant that wasn't such a big issue, because I couldn't go with her. She went with the school. And I sat there all night thinking, they're going to phone and say that she's had to come out. And they were brilliant with her. They said, look, if you need to leave the theatre, you can. And we've got it running on a TV screen in this room, so you can just come and sit in here. And that just seemed to make all the difference. And she came in that evening and she was flying as high as a kite. She was so inspired. And she learned the songs and she sang the songs. And that's just priceless, just to see, well, say a young person, but any person inspired by something they've seen or heard or touched. And I just want that for other families, which is what drives me all the time, because there are so many families who are really struggling and feel very isolated. Funding for schools, and so this is all over the news at the moment, special education is just being cut all the time. And just having time to go out as a family and enjoy yourself. And it's not all about education and learning. Sometimes it's just about being together.
And on this note,
Claire, thank you so much.
Would love
thank
to thank you.
You.
Thank you for coming.
Lovely. Stressful. Thank you.
If you like this week's episode, go ahead and subscribe and join the conversation on our social media. You can follow us on Instagram at For Art's Sake
and Twitter at @sake_arts.
You can also find us at our website at www.forartsake.co.uk.
Thank you.